We'll hear argument next in Gonzalez versus Ucentro Espirita Beneficiente Uniado Vegetal. Mr. Needler.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Court of Appeals decision in this case carves out an exception to the categorical prohibitions of the Controlled Substances Act in order to permit respondents to import, distribute, and use a Schedule I controlled substance. The Court of Appeals believed this exception was justified by the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in order to enable respondents to use Huasca T, which contains dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, in the substance for religious purposes. The Court of Appeals was wrong. RFRA carries forward the compelling interest test as set forth in prior federal court decisions.
May I address a preliminary inquiry that I have? Are we reviewing here the issuance of the injunction by the trial court?
Yes, a preliminary injunction.
And we have to find that for the trial court to have issued it, it was an abuse of discretion?
Well, with respect to certain aspects of the preliminary injunction question, yes. For example, whether a preliminary injunction should is the proper remedy if all the other criteria are satisfied.
You know, but the court found evidence in equipoise and so on and so forth. So I just wondered at the bottom line what our legal standard is here.
Yes, we believe that the Court of Appeals erred, District Court and Court of Appeals erred as a matter of law in entering the injunction.
Abused its discretion.
Well, a court always abuses its discretion if it commits a legal error. So that is basically our position
here. It seems to me your position is that we must give controlling determinative weight to the fact that it's listed in Schedule I. And the respondents say you don't give it any weight at all. It's all on a case-by-case basis. Is there a middle ground that which I think would allow you to prevail here, that there is a presumption that there is a compelling governmental interest when it's in Schedule I? It's a rebuttable presumption, but it's a presumption that when it's in Schedule I, it's a compelling interest.
Well, first of all, our principal submission is that Congress's designation in Schedule I is sufficient unto itself. But we also do include a further submission that if the Court didn't disagree with that, that Congress in Schedule I has said that any mixture containing any amount of a listed hallucinogenic substance is barred. And there's no question that this substance contains that. But if the Court was going to look beyond that to the facts of this case, there's also no question in this case that respondents' use of the substance produces the very effects that led Congress to put the substance on Schedule I. So to allow the substance to be used would be in direct derogation of Congress's judgment. The disagreement, such as there is, goes not to that question, and that's on page 214A of the joint appendix or the petition appendix. The district court specifically found that those effects are produced. Respondents' argument in the lower courts was essentially that those effects shouldn't matter or that those effects should be ignored. But we think that that's inconsistent with Congress's judgment. So my point is, if you go beyond the text of the statute, it shouldn't be for anything more than for the Court to assure itself that the effects that caused Congress to list the subject, in fact, occur.
But part of the statute is Sherbert and Verner, and the test that Congress says we have to apply to its acts here.
Right. But under the Act does say carry forward the prior federal court decisions, but prior to Smith, this Court on a number of occasions had recognized the compelling interest in uniform enforcement of important statutes that could not function under a system of individualized religious exemption.
Mr. Needler, I think everyone would concede that there is a compelling interest, governmental interest, to have the Controlled Substances Act on that level, yes. But then Congress has passed another statute that says all laws shall be subject to RFRA, So we can't just look at, is there a compelling state interest for the Controlled Substances Act in a vacuum, we have to take what was a later statute, RFRA, to which the Controlled Substances Act is made subject by Congress. And I thought the argument was, is there a compelling state interest in that context? How can there be, given the situation with peyote, and we're just like the Native American church in that regard?
Well, the argument is not that the Controlled Substances Act is not subject to RFRA. It is subject to RFRA, but just as it was subject to the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause. And in this Court's pre-Smith cases, in which the Court, at least Congress understood the Court to have been applying a compelling interest test, the Court was applying that compelling interest test to particular statutes under which individualized religious exemptions would not be feasible, and held as a categorical matter that they were not required. The Social Security Act, the tax code, the laws against polygamy, the Sunday closing laws, all of those were ones in which the Court had previously concluded that individualized exceptions were not appropriate.
I would understand that if the government had acted uniformly, but we do have two situations that seem to be like the peyote and this case. And if the government must accommodate to one, why not to the other?
In the peyote exception, Congress was acting under its distinct constitutionally recognized authority with respect to Indian tribes. The Indian Commerce Clause specifically authorizes Congress to legislate with respect to Indian tribes.
But it still shows whatever power they were proceeding under, it still shows that it's not all that important that nobody be able to use a substance banned by Category 1.
Well,
whatever power it was under, it's a demonstration that you can make an exception without the sky falling.
Well, I in no way think that did Congress believe that by enacting the special provision for Indian tribes, it was thereby opening the Controlled Substances Act to individualized religious exceptions.
Maybe Congress didn't assume that. They probably didn't think about it. But what's wrong with the argument?
Well, I think what's wrong with the argument is that what Congress did with respect to Indian tribes was take a look at that distinct context and conclude that for a variety of reasons, and particularly respecting the autonomous authority of an independent Indian tribe to control its internal affairs, this exception applies only to members of recognized Indian tribes, that in that context, balancing all of the relevant considerations, not the sort of balance under RFRA, but balancing all the considerations under its Indian power, concluded
that Justice Scalia's point is, no matter what the legal theory, the evidence, historical evidence, seems to indicate that the sky didn't fall. And if it didn't fall for the larger number of Native Americans involved who use peyote, the very small number using this drug, can't we kind of think that at least, well, maybe it's not all that compelling?
But that was a specific judgment made by Congress itself,
but
looking
Mr.
at all the factors.
May I stop you there? Because correct me if I'm wrong, but it was my impression that the DEA was allowing an exemption for peyote use by the Native American Church before Congress passed the law.
That's correct, but that was understood back in 1970, or back at, actually in 65, when that was first adopted, to have been consistent with Congress's original intent in passing the statute and then the Controlled Substances Act, which carried forward the schedules. But in any event, Congress has now addressed the subject by statute following the enactment of RFRA, following this Court's decision in Smith, and which has brought things into quite different focus.
But if you take it that the government was right before Congress passed the law, the government was right to give the exemption to allow that ceremonial use of peyote, then I don't see how you get mileage from a congressional act that was passed later than Congress is saying, executive, we agree with you, you did right. But it's not. I don't see how you can rely on the congressional statute when the government was doing this, even without a.
Yes, and the statute actually, you know, now gives some firm statutory basis for that exception, which may not really have existed so comfortably after this Court's Smith decision in Smith. And there was, it's true, nothing specific in the statute before. The critical point, though, to bear in mind for the sort of claim that, respondents are arguing for here is that it would turn over to 700 district judges a determination based on particular records, particular credibility determinations, the judgment as to whether —
But isn't that exactly what the Act does? That's why they passed it.
With all respect —
And that's why we came out the other way in Smith,
But even when Congress went back to pre-Smith, again, Congress recognized that there are certain statutes that serve a compelling interest that would be undermined by individualized determinations and the Controlled Substances
Act. Well, it didn't say that, did it? I mean, it did seem to indicate, after the passage of RFRA, courts are supposed to examine in each case whether there's a compelling state interest and whether it's closely enough related.
But that was the test that the Court was applying, as Congress understood it, prior to Smith, in which, I repeat, the Court said there were certain statutes that the categorical judgments could be made about. And the Controlled Substances Act is such a statute, as this Court recognized in Raich and in Oakland Cannabis.
I want you to stay on this point because it's important. But if this were a Schedule II substance, would your argument be the same?
Our argument would be the same, but for an additional reason there, and that is that even where Congress has — or even where a substance may be distributed and used, it is only for medical purposes, which is in furtherance of, not in derogation of, the health and safety purposes of the statute. And even then, it is done to very strict — pursuant to very strict controls that are really incompatible with a sacramental use of a substance. There's a requirement of prescription or dispensing by a physician under physician control, with record keeping identifying the dosage, the amount of the sacrament, record keeping of the person who takes it. There is an incompatibility and potential entanglement problem in trying to apply a system like that, even under Schedule II. But under Schedule I, what you have is contraband, as this Court said.
Suppose I grant you that administrative considerations are relevant. Of course they're relevant. But that's far from saying they're determinative. And then we're back to what Justice Souter said. Absolutely relevant in deciding the compelling interest, but the fact that peyote seems to have been administered without the sky falling in suggests that here they're not determinative. That's all.
Well, if I could go back to the way the Controlled Substances Act operates, it does not permit a rescheduling or use of a drug based on individualized determinations made by individual federal district courts making their own judgment about how serious the risk is. If a substance is going to be moved from Schedule I to Schedule II, for example, to allow medical use, that is done through a centralized administrative determination involving coordination between the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the Attorney General, in which expert opinions are gotten and a judgment is made. But the judgment is made only if there is an accepted medical use. In other words, there has to be not a consensus, not simply a determination by one religious group or one judge that something may be so.
RFRA overrides all that.
No,
I understand RFRA to be to say there can be an exception to all federal statutes where someone makes a religious objection to compliance. And in the judgment of the court, there's not a compelling state interest in the government going ahead with the statute. So, you know, whatever the scheme was under the drug laws, it seems to me it's subject to this new legislation.
Well, we're not saying it's not subject to the legislation, but in deciding how the compelling interest applies under the statute, just as under the First Amendment itself, before RFRA was passed, and the one is to replicate the other, the court, there were certain statutes. When the court looked at the way they operated and what was necessary to their effectuation, the court said that individualized exceptions would not be feasible. And there's no reason to believe and every reason to disbelieve Congress meant to put that to one side.
Reasons to believe and disbelieve. We don't have to make a once-and-for-all determination, do we? A lot of your concerns talk about what's going to happen if this exception is granted. Now, if some of those things come true, can't this issue be revisited? I don't regard — maybe I'm wrong, but under RFRA, you're not saying it's a compelling interest test. It may be may not be satisfied in this case, but if it turns out there's a lot of diversion of the hallucinogen or the membership of the church expands in a way that leads you to believe it's being abused, I mean, then you'd look at it again, right?
I have several responses to that. That sort of approach, putting to the test, basically a congregation by congregation or denomination by denomination, to use familiar terms, test about whether an exception should be recognized for a particular religion, itself presents difficult questions. If you have a particular religious sect that believes that it is important to invite everyone to the table, not simply a closed group that has gone through screening, but everyone to their table. A court would be in a judgment about in saying that that
couldn't have said it better, and that's what we said in Smith. But Congress didn't like Smith and has enacted this statute, obviously, to undo, to the extent it can, the effect of our judgment in Smith.
No, it did not seek to undo the judgment in Smith. What Congress was responding to was what it understood to be the test. It reinstated the compelling interest test, but specifically said it was not disagreeing with the outcome of any particular case under that prior test. And three of those cases, Hernandez concerning the tax code, Lee concerning the Social Security Act, and Braunfeld regarding the Sunday closing laws, were all ones that adopted the approach that I have suggested.
But your approach is totally categorical. If you had a group that had once a year one drop of the hallucinogen involved here per member, and it was rigorously policed, your position would still be the same, even applying RFRA, which sets forth a compelling interest test.
Our principal position would be the same, and I think that approach is consistent with Justice O'Connor's opinion in Smith, which got a lot of prominence in the subsequent debate about RFRA. Because in that opinion, even though the compelling interest test was applied, Justice O'Connor concluded that test was satisfied because
— Congress disagreed ultimately. They allowed the use of peyote.
And that's an important point. Congress doing it does not open the Controlled Substances Act to the individualized determinations by 700 district courts. It makes a centralized judgment.
May Congress, consistent with the Establishment Clause, say that we will create an exception for peyote, but not for this other church, which has far fewer members, less risk of diversion, has been found to be a genuine religion? The problem of preferring one religious group over another, it seems to me, arises once there is an exception for the Native American church. And I heard you say, well, the Indian tribes are special, but that's it?
We think that's critical because just as in this Court's decision in Lara, what Congress has done is to act to respect the autonomous and independent institutions of the tribe. That also meets certain law enforcement concerns because you have a tribal government, you have tribal law enforcement personnel, you have tribal culture and tradition that is independent simply of the religion. You have the entire tribal cultural structure that Congress could quite reasonably regard as being different and respecting that distinct political attribute of tribes under this Court's decision of Morton versus Mancari, we don't think creates an Establishment Clause problem.
May I ask you one question about the procedural posture of this case? This is an appeal from a preliminary injunction. That's how it got here. And we have been discussing mostly the case just as though it had been a permanent injunction. There are pieces of this case, like the treaty and what it allows and doesn't allow, that where the record is so thin. Is there a way of dealing with this case so there is the full airing that it never got without resolving at this point issues you've been debating?
On that limited point, if the Court applied the usual standards for the granting of a preliminary injunction, I think the Court could quite readily reverse the preliminary injunction here because that requires a clear showing of a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, plus that the other factors be decided. And with respect to the application of the convention, that's really a question of law. And the United States took the position before the district court in this case that the convention applied to the tea. We think it's unquestionably a mixture and therefore a preparation within the meaning of the convention. And the district court's injunction really puts the United States in violation of an international agreement that is critical to prohibiting trafficking in drugs.
Do your briefs indicate, or does the record indicate, that the government was foreclosed from presenting any evidence it wanted to present? If you for some reason go back and this whole thing is done again, is there important additional evidence for you to introduce, or do we essentially have the case in front of us, so far as you're concerned?
Well, as far as our position is concerned on our submission so far, we don't think the court needs any further evidence. On the question of the application of the convention, as we say, we believe that is a question of law. This court has long deferred to the position of the executive branch on the interpretation of conventions.
Counsel, I was a little unclear about your position on the convention. I thought at one point you said that it didn't really add much to your argument under the Controlled Substances Act, which implemented the convention.
Is it an independent argument? No, we believe that complying with an international convention designed to prohibit trafficking in drugs is itself a compelling interest. And under this court's decisions that would be incorporated in RFRA, and an order that puts the United States in violation of that. And the Court of Appeals didn't really deny, a majority of the judges anyway, deny that this injunction requires the United States to violate the convention facilitating the importation of drugs from outside the country.
Here's the problem that I have, particularly at the stage of the preliminary injunction with that argument. The convention also includes that provision that its terms will be defined, enforced, and so on in harmony or conformity with the domestic law of the signatory. Our domestic law includes RFRA. That would seem to open the door for, in effect, a RFRA exception.
Let me get to my question
before you answer it. The particular concern I have with that at the preliminary injunction stage is not necessarily that particular argument should, for all times, be assessed correctly by the district court. But it seems to me that if the district court at least plausibly reads that exception to negate your argument, isn't that good enough at the preliminary injunction stage as a basis for the court saying, look, you the government, haven't carried your burden to show the affirmative defense here?
This is the interpretation of the convention is a legal question, not a factual one. And Article 22 refers —
It is. There's no question. But we're still at the preliminary injunction stage.
Right. But respondent would bear the burden of —
Why does the respondent bear the burden? You have the burden under the statute.
Because this is a change of the status quo. To require the government to allow the importation of a substance that's prohibited by the convention. But if I could —
but I realize that. Could we pause on that for a second? Because you apparently take the position, the government takes the position, that when under the governing law the government would have an affirmative burden ultimately to defend, in this case on compelling interest, least restrictive, et cetera, that at the preliminary injunction stage, the applicant for the injunction has the burden to negate the probability that the government will carry its burden on the ultimate issue, and I don't see why that should be so at all.
Well, at least with respect to the interpretation of a convention where the government —
No, but let, just —
No, I, the, I understand, general, I understand
get
the
to
broader
the convention
point.
Later. Get to the general — first get to the general issue. Does the applicant for the injunction have the burden to negate the probability that the government will prevail in its affirmative defense ultimately? Is that your position?
Yes, that is our position, and we cite cases in the brief that say that, but it is not critical to the outcome of this case with respect to the convention issue and several other of the issues that I was going to say.
Well, the convention issue goes directly to your affirmative defense.
But it is a question of law, and the article of the convention that you're referring to concerns the penal provisions. In other words, Article 7 of the convention requires each party to prohibit this is Article 7 on page 288A, requires that each state to prohibit these substances. 22 simply goes to the criminal provisions that that each party state will adopt internally to carry that out. But it doesn't detract from the categorical obligation under Article 7 to prohibit.
The treaty question that I had is also, this is a route that you are, and it contains DMT. And the treaty doesn't ban everything that contains DMT, for example, pineapple and bananas. The question is the ratio of the DMT to the entire plant.
Well,
and that sounds like a factual question that ought to be developed.
Well, I think where you have a mixture that include a mixture of two plants that are put together for the specific purpose of using them for the hallucinogenic purposes, that goes far beyond simply whether a particular substance.
Pineapples, we what about those?
Well,
I drank pineapple juice this morning.
Plants as such are not covered, but when you make a mixture of something for the specific purpose of releasing its hallucinogenic purpose qualities, we think that that's clearly covered by the convention.
Thank you, Mr. Kneedler. Ms. Hollander.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the government's position here that the Court should completely defer to Congress's generalized findings, wholly exempt Schedule I of the Controlled Substances Act from RFRA's mandate, is fundamentally and structurally incompatible with RFRA.
But you seem to give the fact that it's listed in Schedule I zero weight. It seems to me, at the very least, there should be a presumption that this is a compelling interest.
Yes, Your Honor.
And when the evidence is in equipoise, as the district judge thought it would, that presumption, it seems to me, carries the day for the government.
Your Honor, the district court, we give it deference, as did the district court. Judge Parker specifically found, contrary to what the government says, that he began by looking at Schedule I. And he specifically says, I believe it's on page 212A of the petitioner's appendix, that he had to begin there, and he said this court must give due regard for the fact that Congress put DMT into Schedule I. But then he applied RFRA, and in applying RFRA, he went on to apply RFRA and to specifically find that applying RFRA, which requires not only a compelling interest, but a compelling interest to the person, that the government did not meet its burden in this case of showing harm, any risk of harm to these members or any risk of diversion. And I'd like to go back for a moment to the issue of peyote because, first of all, if you look at the congressional record in 1965, for what that's worth, there's not one mention, and it's on page, starts on page 480 of the Joint Appendix, there's no mention of Indian tribes. There's no mention of sovereign issues with the Indian tribes. There's a mention of the Native American Church and the First Amendment and why this exemption has to be made. And, in fact, our record is
Do we know whether you can be a member of that church without being an Indian?
Yes, sir, we do, Your Honor. We know that, and it is throughout our brief. There's many mentions of it. The fact that there have been non-Native American members since the beginning of the Native American Church. I would direct the Court to the easiest one, which is at the Joint Appendix at page 500, which is a memo from a DEA legal counsel talking about this. And, in fact, at the hearing in our case, on the very last day, it was on November 2nd, 2001, at page 1933, Mr. Adam Zubin, representing the government, specifically said, and I quote, "The federal government places no restrictions on who can participate in the Native American Church." So we have two things. We have the exemption in 1965.
So your theory would be if you had a religious group whose doctrine was that you should proselytize through WASCA and they want everybody to come and they're aggressive in doing that and distributing WASCA, that the government should be in a position of saying this religious group can use it, but that religious group can't?
Your Honor, it would depend, again, on the facts of that case.
Yeah, they're kind of the ones I just gave you. In other words, if there's going to be a greater threat of diversion to — it's not limited to the members of a very cohesive and limited group, but it's — they aggressively try to reach out, but it's all part of a sincere religious belief that we should, in applying RFRA, draw distinctions between the group you represent and that hypothetical group?
The distinctions — yes and no, and let me explain, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice. The distinction is that if the government could meet a compelling interest and actually show a risk of diversion
— well, I'm assuming they show that there
that
is —
that they showed it,
yeah.
Then they would have different facts. And the different facts in that case would mean that in that case the government would win. Now, I'd like to point out, although I realize you've just presented me with a hypothetical, however — there are 250,000 members of the Native American Church, and the record in our case is that there's never been any evidence of any diversion. And although the government has
— if we think that the treaty, the convention entered into in 1971, makes clear that WASCA is covered, then does that provide a compelling interest for the government because it requires the government to prohibit the importation? If we think, as a matter of law, the convention covers WASCA.
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because, again, the government has to — we have to look at the treaty just like we look at any other law. RFRA clearly says —
well, if we conclude, looking at the treaty, that it prohibits WASCA, covers it, and that it provides that nations that enter into the convention — must avoid importation of it, then is that a compelling interest under RFRA?
It may — yes, Your Honor, it may be a compelling interest, but it still may not satisfy RFRA because RFRA specifically requires that it be a compelling interest to the person. And we — the government would have to put on evidence, and even though this is a question of law, that doesn't preclude the district court hearing evidence, which he has not heard to this point. Put on evidence showing that the compelling interest the government has asserted in this case, which is that it would lose its leadership position in the international community, would really be a compelling interest and that it could not be accommodated.
That isn't the compelling interest. The compelling interest is we signed a treaty and you follow it. Now, how can you say that the government wouldn't have a compelling interest in following a treaty where they promised to ban the substance? I mean, they're just saying RFRA doesn't apply where that's at stake. Now, what's the argument against that? You're saying the argument against that is maybe it really isn't a compelling interest? Well, okay, why not? I mean, it sounds to me as if it would be. They have a treaty. They have to live up to their word, period. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with that, Your Honor. The what's wrong with that is that RFRA requires the government to go further than that.
It does. Right, that's an issue, I guess. I'd have to decide, is a compelling interest, does it require the government to go further? But you concede that if it doesn't require the government to go further, you lose.
If the treaty does include WASCA, which we believe that it doesn't.
All right, so that's a different issue. Why doesn't it?
Why doesn't it? It doesn't. And interestingly, the executive took the reverse position that it's taking here throughout the history of this treaty until this litigation. And it doesn't cover WASCA because it doesn't cover plants or infusions from plants. And that is the position. And the reason why the U.S. would not lose its leadership position is that that's the position of Brazil, which allows religious
whose position it is, the language does not admit of that exception. There's nothing in the language of it that would suggest that exception at all. What language do you rely upon for that exception?
The treaty — we have to rely, Your Honor, on the treaty as a whole. And
as a
what,
whole? Anywhere in it. Give me language anywhere in the whole treaty suggests that exception.
The treaty that the language that suggests that exception is, first of all, in Article 32 that talks about the traditional use of plants. It is in the fact that plants are not covered, and so a preparation —
but a solution that includes the substance DMT is covered by definition, as I understand it. T is a solution, and it includes DMT. Isn't that the end of the issue?
No, Your Honor, it isn't. And the reason it isn't is if we look several places. One is the conduct of our treaty partners, none of whom agree with that position.
Well, what's wrong? Can you tell me on the face of it what's wrong with it? I mean, if I have tea at 5 o'clock, I think I'm drinking a solution that includes the little things that come out of the tea leaves, and that's what we've got involved here.
And maybe our treaty partners are just violating the treaty.
Well, Your Honor, if they are, then we are also, because
— tell me what's wrong with the analysis of the solution.
I have specific language from the treaty's commentary in front of me that supports you. Are you not going to read that?
I was trying —
She's not going to read it because I asked her for language in the treaty. Not in the legislative history of the treaty.
I was trying to answer Justice Scalia's question, but let me say this. And of course, I would read the language of the commentary and the INCB and the opinion of our former ambassador, Herbert Oken, in Brazil and France. But let me also say, if I may, that the position of the executive until this litigation has been the same. And the reason we know that is precisely what you said, Your Honor. Mescaline is also covered by the treaty. Peyote is not.
That's because we made a special reservation for peyote.
No, Mr. Chief Justice, we did make a special reservation, but it didn't matter yet because it's never been covered. That reservation, if you go back and look at what the Senate said at the time and what — there are no plants. They're just not listed in the treaty. The purpose of the reservation was in an abundance of caution in case it would be — in case it would be added in the future, then plants and solutions from plants would be covered. But as it stands now, members of the Native American Church drink a tea containing peyote.
Well, are you saying that this is basically an ambiguity in the treaty, that solutions derived from plants are not covered, but solutions that include DMT are covered, and therefore there is a question?
The ambiguity arises because what the treaty means is that if you were to extract the DMT and then add it to something, which can't be done here and would have no religious meaning for the UDV, and we're not even sure chemically if it's possible, if you were to extract it and then add it, then you would have a solution containing DMT.
But solution is defined by the number of steps in the process that gets the substance into the water? Is that correct?
Your Honor, I didn't write this treaty, and I must say
— Oh, I'm not blaming you for
that,
it.
That it's — it's not the clearest writing, but we know what its meaning is, and we do have to look at the Trevaux, which goes into long detail about why they even mention plants, because of their fear in the future that plants might be covered. Now, other plants are covered in a different treaty. But
can I make a suggestion as to why, even if it is covered by the treaty, it may not be a compelling state interest to comply with the treaty?
Say yes. Let
well, yes, yes. I'm just waiting.
It was the right answer.
I'm just trying to be polite.
Isn't it well established that statutes trump treaties, that if Congress decides in a subsequent statute to ignore a treaty, it may do so? Now, if this RFRA can trump a statute, it would seem to me, a fortiori, it can trump a treaty.
Yes, it can. Your Honor, it can trump the treaty, and that is correct.
So compliance with the treaty is not necessarily a compelling state interest.
It is not, but we don't even have to go that far, because if we do the RFRA analysis, the government must show a compelling interest to the person, and in addition,
But surely RFRA doesn't say that you disregard treaties or you disregard statutes in determining what's a compelling interest.
No. You don't disregard them, Your Honor.
And getting back to the first question that Justice Breyer asked, and then we got off on what the treaty really means, but assuming that the treaty does prohibit the importation of this substance, assuming that, is there any evidence that the district court thought that this was a compelling interest?
Well, the district court analyzed the treaty differently and analyzed the treaty to not apply to Huasca. for all the reasons that are in his opinion in our brief, and therefore.
So if we disagree with you on the treaty, then the appellate court's opinion doesn't really even address the point whether or not this and or the statute together can be a compelling interest.
That's correct. If you disagree with the district court on that, then the case should be remanded for additional.
I don't know if there isn't a factual question here. I mean, I thought Justice Scalia, but it would be up to him, did take into account official commentaries to treaties, but maybe he doesn't. Anyway, I take them into account. And in respect to that, I read this as saying specifically that the plants, it doesn't include the substance if it is a substance clearly distinguished from the substance constituting its active principle, and the example they give is mimosa root, which contains DMT.
That's true.
And that's also true of the bananas and pineapples, et cetera, and there's a court holding the ayahuasca's out of it in France and one in the Netherlands, all of which I think was relevant to a treaty. All right? Now, the government has come in with a counterargument and said it clearly does cover, I guess, even mimosa roots, where they are imported solely for the purpose of extracting DMT. Now, what's the response to that?
And the response to that, Your Honor, is that there is no DMT extracted in this case. Although the government said that in their brief, there is no evidence of that, and it is contrary to the evidence.
Well, it has to be extracted at some point to get into the tea, right? It's extracted by the preparation of the tea.
No, Mr. Chief.
The plants are not imported, right? Just the tea.
The tea is imported, but the tea is made just like you would make tea if you mixed chamomile and mint, and then you took the leaves out. What you have in that tea is a collection of a tremendous number of alkaloids. And what the commentary is saying is that you would have to pull this alkaloid out, and that would be a chemical process.
If I could just go back to the point, you're emphasizing that the treaty doesn't cover the importation of plants, but you're not importing plants. You're importing a mixture that must contain the covered hallucinogen or it doesn't have its effect.
That's correct. However, under the treaty, it's not covered by the treaty because it is not separate. If DMT were separated, then it would be covered by the treaty. And actually, if you look at the 1988 treaty, going even farther, and its commentary, the commentary in the 1988 treaty, which has to be read in connection with the 1971 treaty, specifically defines preparation as the extraction
of the drug. So under
your theory,
a marijuana tea would not be covered by the treaty?
Not by this treaty, but that marijuana, coca leaves and poppies are specifically covered by the 1961 treaty.
Yeah, but they're not being imported. They're transformed into this tea, and you're saying the active substance isn't there independently, so it's not covered. And that seems to me to be an erroneous reading of the treaty.
Well, the difference, for example, with marijuana is that if you look at the 1961 treaty, it says the plant, all parts of the plant, everything from the plant, it's all covered. What the 1971 treaty did was different. And if you read the 1971 treaty and the 1988 treaty and their commentaries, if I can rely on their commentaries, and the International Narcotics Control Board, what they are expressing is a concern for the traditional religious and mystical use of plants in religion. And that's what they were concerned about. And that's why they didn't put this in. And that's why they specifically have in the commentary that the example of mimosa, and they also have an example of peyote in the same paragraph 12.
About commentary or travaux, I don't mind using them for treaties so long as they don't contradict the treaty. Do we have any case where we use the travaux préparatoires to actually contradict the language of the treaty? That's what it seems to me is going on here.
No, Your Honor, it's not contradicting the treaty because the government is taking this one sentence preparation and the government has a definition of it for this litigation only. That is contrary to the definition in the treaty, the way it is interpreted by the travaux and by the commentary and by this executive, which means that the executive's position here is really entitled to no deference, because otherwise the tea drunk by the Native American church, the peyote tea, would also be cut.
As I understand the treaty, what the treaty says is you can't import substances listed in Schedule 1. Then you look at Schedule 1, and it doesn't say ayahuasca.
That's
it says DMT. And then it has another, and in interpreting that, it says, the fact that you look at that list and it says DMT means what it says. You can't import DMT. It's a drug importation statute, and it doesn't cover plants that contain the substance DMT. Otherwise, we'd have throw out bananas and, or mimosa anyway. And we're not looking to intent on that. Now, that's a possible interpretation that doesn't contradict anything.
Well, except that you don't import the plants, right?
That's correct. And we don't import DMT. We import a tea that contains enormous number of alkaloids. And it was clear in an...
Well, that's harder then.
It's clear...
Of course, the reason you import it is because it contains this particular substance.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct. However, the treaty wanted to be, the treaty writers were very careful to not impinge on traditional religious use. And RFRA, and there's one more thing that I've been trying to say, and that is that RFRA requires not just a compelling interest, but a compelling interest to the person, and it requires least
what
restrictive
means. What do you
mean
by that?
Means.
You said that before.
Would you explain that again? You said a compelling interest to the to what person?
To the person.
Yeah.
To what?
To the aggrieved person. To this particular religion.
The government. Compelling interest in enforcing it against the aggrieved person. Isn't that what you mean?
Right.
That's right. That's correct. But RFRA also requires that the government prove, if it proves a compelling interest, to enforce it against the person. And if it gets there, it also must prove that it is furthering that compelling interest by the least restrictive means.
But
now,
if the interest is defined as Mr. Needler did, that is, these drugs are absolutely prohibited, then how can you have any less restrictive means? Seems to me that you can — I understand your argument about a compelling state interest has to be judged in context to the person, to this church. But if Mr. Needler is correct that the compelling state interest is that this is a proscribed drug, then there can't be any least restrictive means.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor. For example, other countries that have domestic policies have found ways to accommodate that have not violated the treaty. For example, Switzerland provides needles and heroin to its drug users. And the United States has not objected that this is a violation of the treaty.
What about — I worry about the general proposition we would be adopting if we say, you know, one narrow exception is not a — doesn't — contravene a compelling state interest. What about I assume there is still a federal law against bigamy that applies in federal territories. Now, what if a small religious group comes forward and says, our religion requires bigamy? You're not a whole lot of us; we're just a little tiny group. So we demand under RFRA an exemption from this absolute law. Why does it have to be absolute? It's just a little tiny exception, only a few of us.
Well,
at least for now.
Until they reproduce. Your Honor, the analysis would be the same. First, that religion would have to prove it was a sincere religion and meet that burden, and then the government could come forward with a compelling interest and perhaps find the same thing that was found in Reynolds, which was not a strict scrutiny case, but may come out the same way, the sanctity of marriage, the other issues. And those would be issues of fact for a district judge to decide under his discretion. And it all RFRA does is give every religious organization, the minority ones and the majority ones, the opportunity to go into court as an aggrieved person and make their claim and see whether the government can meet its burden.
May I ask you a question that's tangential to this a little bit? Going back to the Chief Justice's question earlier about diversion, And his suggestion was, if they're proselyte the religion, get all sorts of converts who just use it in the same way as the small number use it now, would that be diversion, or would it be diversion diverting it to some people who are not members of the religion?
Well,
what does the word diversion mean in this context?
Diversion, Your Honor, is a term of art here, and I thought I answered it that way, but maybe I was unclear. It means diversion from licit use to illicit use. So if,
and then getting more members to convert it to the religion would not be diversion.
No, it would not be diversion. There would only be a problem if the government, for example, showed that there was some diversion outside, and that's why I used the example of the Native American church. There's never been any diversion. I'd like to go back to one other issue that perhaps I didn't make clear. It's true that the UDV does not import the plants, but it's those plants that are sacred to the UDV. It can't substitute them. Not only is DMT in bananas and pineapple, but phalaris grass, for example, that and there's a picture of one in our joint appendix at page 518, I believe, grows in this country. A recreational user could just go and, you know, mix the phalaris grass.
I was not right. You do import drums of tea, and they say in the treaty that a preparation is a solution or mixture containing a substance. And it would seem to be a solution or mixture containing DMT. And the commentary that I thought helped you does concern plants, but you're not importing plants. So now I'm rather troubled to see if there is any way that this treaty is interpreted in a manner that allows you to win. What is it?
Well, what the commentary says is that it is not a covered preparation, that an infusion or tea made from the roots of a plant is not a covered preparation. And
Ms. Alder, may I just, on this point, it's the same question I raised with Mr. Needler. We're talking about a preliminary injunction. Your side, I think, said if we go for the permanent injunction, we have a lot more to put in. The presentation on the treaty was rather thin below. I take it from Mr. Needler's argument that he's saying the preliminary injunction or not is really the thing. If the government wins, no preliminary injunction, there's not going to be any show for a permanent injunction. But on your side of it, what more would you be putting in? Let's say you prevail at the preliminary injunction stage. Would you then say, see, Judge, now you can enter a permanent injunction? Or would you be putting in more evidence, and if so, what kind?
Well, we certainly have a great deal of more evidence, Your Honor, that we can put in. We have substantial evidence on the treaty and evidence we haven't even talked about here proving that this WASCA is not covered by the treaty. We have additional health and safety evidence. We have additional evidence to show lack of diversion. We have additional evidence that Judge Parker talks about to show targeting of the religion and selective prosecution. We have a great deal more evidence we can put on, but of course it depends on what the government puts on, because at this point the government has not met any of its burdens. Now, you're correct about the treaty. None of that has gone on. The government resisted any evidence about the treaty, resisted the very best evidence, which was the International Narcotics Control Board's opinion that WASCA is not covered by the treaty. And we now have more that we would put on. And, you know, what the church and its members seek is just the right to practice their religious faith as Congress guaranteed them in RFRA, because Congress guaranteed then recognized that religious liberty is a core value in this country. Two courts below found on a lengthy factual record that the government had not met the burdens Congress imposed. This court should do, even if this court believes that it's a close question, should do then what it did in Ashcroft v. ACLU, affirm the preliminary injunction, remand this case for a trial on the merits. If this court were to do anything less than that, it's really to deny Congress's intent and Congress's policy here, because Congress's policy is that religious freedom, religious liberty, shall not be burdened unless and until the government meets its burdens. The district court clearly found and said that the government did not show a risk of harm, did not show a risk of diversion, and therefore he found that the government did not meet its compelling interests in this case. And we would ask the court to affirm the preliminary injunction, remand this case to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hollinger. Mr. Kneedler, you have 4 minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. If I may focus first on the question of importation, no country in the world would permit the exportation and importation of preparations that contain a substance listed under the convention because the express words of the convention prohibit it. And the commentary that is cited, does all it says is that plants as such are not covered. The plants themselves are not included in the schedule. It then has footnotes describing how the plants may be used, how in a mixture or a solution that contain the DMT or some other subject, and that's precisely the sort of thing that the convention was designed to prohibit. And
But what does that benefit you? I mean, I guess this was Justice Scalia's question he asked earlier. The treaty is — it seems to me if you're willing to override a duly enacted statute, the treaty shouldn't have any greater status.
Well, I don't think RFRA does override it. What RFRA does is take the compelling interests that the government already has in enacted laws or treaties as they are, and then you apply RFRA to them. And
that's the treaty gives you a more compelling governmental interest than the Controlled Substances Act?
I certainly do, and the two together I think are doubly compelling because the United States has a compelling interest in encouraging, and this and Section 801A —
More than doubly. It has to be doubly plus a little if you said the one is even more than the other.
Congress itself and the statute implementing this convention said it is essential to have international cooperation in the protection of the drugs covered by the statute. So you have a statutory determination that this is critical anyway.
So we have to agree with you, though, that our treaty partners in this area have sort of a zero-tolerance approach to enforcing
this. No, not at all. First, as a general matter, of course, the United States has a compelling interest in living up to its treaties. But under this treaty in particular, the United States has to be in a position to go to other countries, maybe countries that are dragging their feet about whether to take enforcement measures and say, you have an obligation to strictly construe this convention. And if they are able to come back and say that you yourselves have not been doing that, that undermines the ability of the United States in enforcing a treaty designed to prohibit international trafficking in controlled substances. And nothing in this Court's First Amendment cases would have suggested that there is a free exercise right.
Well, that's actually why I've been looking. I'm bothered by it, because if the treaty is absolute, we reserve for peyote, which would mean the religious use of peyote by the Native American tribes is exempt. But other people who have identical religions use identical substances, they're stuck. And that, it seems to me, is a rather rough problem under the First Amendment.
Well,
one religion signaled out, and therefore I'm looking for some way in this treaty not to reach that conclusion
well, with
the Constitution.
With respect to peyote, the convention does not allow the importation or exportation or international trafficking in any substance that there is a reservation taken for. It is a reservation only for the domestic use of plants that are native to that country. So peyote cannot be exported or imported under this convention. And so the idea there's nothing inconsistent with respect to the fundamental threshold question of importation. But even so, we think in Congress's specific Indian power that could be different.
Mr. Kneedler, if you prevail, would there be anything left over to be argued about for a permanent injunction?
No, in our view, on the legal — now, on our principal submission, no, there would not be anything further, because in our view, there's a categorical prohibition against Schedule I substances. That is the compelling interest. The question then is whether, as this Court said in Lee and as Justice O'Connor said in her concurring opinion in Smith, the question is whether an exception would unduly interfere with carrying out that interest, or whether it would be less effective means in terms of being less effective. And we think there's no question that any exception to a categorical bar would violate that standard.
Thank you, Mr. Kneedler. The case is submitted.